Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been a week with historic events on all fronts. The supreme leader of Iran swats away charges that the election was stolen.
Some supporters of candidates should also know that the Islamic Republic state would not cheat and would not betray the vote of the people.
Wall Street sees the biggest reforms proposed since the Great Depression. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says it's time to move.
We're trying to move very, very quickly while the memory of the crisis is still acute in people's minds, because we don't want complacency to set back in. We don't want people to get comfortable again with what we were living with too long for decades.
And healthcare reform takes center stage in Washington, but friction and tensions are already building. Here's Senator John McCain.
I don't believe the government option is an option. I don't think that the government should be running healthcare in America. I think they do a great job on defending the nation. I don't think they do a good job in a lot of other areas.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines, and you can join the conversation. What's your view of the protests in Iran? How do you see the healthcare fight shaping up? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, globetrotting syndicated columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Joining us from KERA in Dallas is Bill McKenzie, syndicated editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, welcome back to you, too.
Thank you, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, welcome to you as always.
Hello, Jane, Trudy, and Bill.
So let's get right to Iran and an important appearance this morning by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. He spoke during morning prayers. He denied last week's election was rigged. He came out clearly supporting President Ahmadinejad. And he warned opponents to stay off the streets. Trudy Rubin, you've been reporting on this region for years. What do you make of this development today?
Well, clearly, as the supreme leader has decided, this thing has gotten too dangerous. It's endangering the whole structure of the regime, full stop. And I'm sure that the Revolutionary Guards, his military backers, told him, get these people off the streets. So this sets up an enormous drama, because he has stated clearly that the blame will be on opposition leaders if there's any violence, which means that the Rev Guards, the besieged, are in the waiting at the ready. And the opposition leaders, especially Mr. Mousavi and his colleague in this opposition, Mr. Rafsanjani, have to decide, are they going to take this risk? Are they going to risk being put in prison? Are they going to risk a Tiananmen moment? But if they call off the demonstrations, then the opposition, for now, just deflates. So this high tension, I think, will be worked out over the weekend. We'll see what the decision is. It may not appear until Sunday, or we may even see tomorrow.
Well, let's listen. They have a meeting. They do have a meeting. I'd like to listen to today, this morning, the Ayatollah again. Here he is, Khamenei, speaking to this huge crowd, telling them the results were valid. He blasted the foreign press for interference in this. This clip we're going to hear now comes to us from the BBC.
The enemies in the media try to show it in a different way. Most of these media belong to the Zionists, evil Zionists. They are trying to show in their media that there is a fight between those who support the state and those who are against the state. But this is not true. They are not telling you the truth. This is not true at all. The four individuals who were competing during the elections, the serious election, were all and are all supporters of the state.
And mobile phone footage showed presidential candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi at a rally in Tehran on Thursday. His supporters, many holding mobile phones in the air, chanted, Mir Hussein and Mousavi, take back our votes. We support you. This next clip, also courtesy of the BBC. Bill McKenzie, back to the U.S., what's your take on how President Obama is responding to all this?
Well, I think up until this moment, he's been doing a very good job. I think he's really found the sweet spot. I think if he had been doing as a lot of conservative critics said, and that was to speak out more for democracy, you know, he would have been at risk of pushing the Ayatollah and all of his group even further away. I thought it was also interesting. James Baker said in Dallas yesterday, former Secretary of State, that he thought Obama was really playing this right. I do. I think, you know, it reminds me a little bit of when Bush 41 was criticized for not going to Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and people got upset. Why weren't you standing up more for this great moment for democracy? And I think you can make the argument that he didn't, by not rubbing into Gorbachev's face at that moment, he made democracy more possible. Now, we don't know if that's going to happen in Iran. I kind of, you know, listening to today's events, I'm a little bit more doubtful that we are going to see democracy unfold a little bit more. But I think Obama, up until this moment, has really been playing his hand right.
Well, here he is, President Obama, telling John Harwood of The New York Times that the U.S. should be cautious in its approach to the situation in Iran.
Although there is amazing ferment taking place in Iran, the difference between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi in terms of their actual policies may not be as great as has been advertised. Either way, we were going to be dealing with an Iranian regime that has historically been hostile to the United States, that has caused some problems in the neighborhood, and is pursuing nuclear weapons.
And here's some GOP lawmakers saying that President Obama is not coming out strongly enough on behalf of the protesters in Iran. Senator John McCain, here he is on CNN earlier this week.
I am frankly incredulous that anybody should say we should abandon our advocacy for free and fair elections anywhere in the world, much less Iran, which is ruled by Muslim clerics who are obviously extremists.
So, Jack Beatty, how do you see the back and forth here? Is the president striking the right tone?
I think he is no less a person than Henry Kissinger said so yesterday. And I think this is what realism is. It's recognizing the real world. And any stronger line from the president would risk essentially tarring the opposition with the charge that they're working for the United States, which is exactly what the forces of repression want there. You know, watching these demonstrations, I've been struck by this thought. Behind all the nuclear diplomacy with which we're engaged in with Iran, or we want to be, there's this implicit threat that maybe there's a military strike in the offing that will strike at the places where they're enriching uranium. Well, looking at those crowds, if you wanted to unite Iran behind the Ayatollahs and make it essentially one nation and prevent and abort the evolution of the society in a more liberal direction, you would strike at it. You would have a military attack. Suddenly, all those millions who seem to want a different sort of society would stand behind their threatened government and nation. And so I think it's really suddenly there's a dramatic presentment of what a military strike could cost and how counterproductive it would be.
Trudy Rubin, let me get back to you, because the Ayatollah this morning said that, quote, street challenge is not acceptable. He said opposition leaders will be held responsible for this chaos if they do not end these protests. So what if there is a crackdown in Iran? Will President Obama have to formulate a new position toward Iran? Can his policy of engagement that we've heard so much about with Iran survive that?
Well, let me start by saying that I totally agree that so far he's been on the right track. George H.W. Bush called on the Iraqis to rise up, and when the Shiites in the south rose, he let Saddam slaughter them, and that is the U.S. situation. Were we to imply that we could actually come to the rescue or be more fervent in supporting Mr. Mousavi, we would not only be dooming him to be arrested as a CIA plant, but we wouldn't be able to deliver. So that's for starters. However, if there is a Tiananmen moment, if there is a massive crackdown, I think it will be very difficult for President Obama to proceed as planned. I do think he has to have a plan B. It's not that he cannot talk to a regime that does such a crackdown. The U.S. talked to China after Tiananmen, but I think he has to understand that such talks are unlikely to go anywhere. Excuse me. I believe that a regime that is willing to crack down not only on half of its public, which I think supports the opposition, but on half of its leadership, because the leadership, unlike what Ayatollah Khamenei said today, is deeply divided. And if they are willing to do that kind of a crackdown, it is basically an insecure, frightened leadership, one that is going to be unwilling to make any concessions, I believe, to the West. And so Obama has to be prepared for that, and I think prepared to try to unite with allies for what is likely to be the need to go for much stronger sanctions.
Bill McKenzie, about 30 seconds before the break. Do you agree? Disagree?
Yes, but I also am interested to see what if some of the clerics will be able to stand up and oppose the supreme leader. Trudy would know more about this than I would, but I'd be very interested to see what their role will be in the coming days.
Three of them have stood up, but unfortunately they're ones that have stood up before and don't have the power to change the momentum. But we will see what happens.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Joining us this hour is Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Let's go right to the phones at the top here. Mehmet is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to point out that, you know, now I'm very glad that the President Obama realized that there's no difference and knows it's so smart to know that there's no difference between people who inherently support the theocracy. And President Khamenei had to, in order to, he did the only thing he could do, the supreme leader, as the leader of that, the real leader of that country, did the only thing he could do under the circumstances, and essentially also admit that there is no difference. These people have been selected by the theocracy. The supreme leader is the Pope. They have something equivalent to the College of Cardinals. And that's why the only party you can belong to is the party of God, because this regime says this represents God. And there is no room for maneuver within the system. But I just want to ask the world community and the influential people on your show, please don't forget the Iranian people, because they are not stupid either. They've been living under this for all these years. They know that it doesn't make any difference, but they have used this conflict of one person saying how corrupt the other person is and the other person getting so insulted that now they have to destroy each other. It's a personal conflict, and these people have become chessboards, chess games. Just please don't forget these poor people. They are using this little ray of light to show to the world that they don't want this regime. And the regime, when they support somebody, they bring the army, they force them to vote for them. People in the government, if they don't vote to, you know, support the regime, they get into trouble because they don't have the stamp on their thing. A lot of it for them is just to get the vote out and put the theatrics out. So the world, and they're upset that the world media isn't treating this as a democracy anymore.
It is an incredible moment in Iran for the people there. Mehmet, thank you for your thoughts. One more call. Nasser is in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Nasser, welcome to the program.
Yes. I listen to NPR all the time. This is my first time ever calling a radio show. And I wanted to let you all know that I'm from Iran, and I've been in the United States for 30 years. And it has come to a point in my own personal life that I am so tired of hearing the rhetoric that I hear in the media in this country. I just wanted to make a comparison for everyone to know. In our last election in the United States between Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain. Let's say, assume that Mr. McCain's supporters thought that Mr. McCain was going to be elected U.S. president. And they took on the streets and they went around, broke down bank buildings, windows, put fire into the government buildings, the town halls. I just want to know how would our police force would react.
Nasser, thank you so much. Well, Trudy,
Rubin.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think as the caller must know if he has followed what's going on in Iran, if he's called family and friends that may still be back there. This was not simply an election that might have gone slightly wrong. In Iran, ballots are counted by hand, and yet the result was announced about 90 minutes after the election closed. Half the ballots were announced as final 4 hours after the election closed. This number of paper ballots in previous elections with far less voters, it has taken at least 24 hours to count those ballots. So there is no question that there was some kind of fraud that goes beyond tinkering, that the count was released. It had to have been pre-cooked. And there has been much, much analysis of this written. Moreover, one of the amazing things about these demonstrations is how nonviolent they have been. There have been a few small incidents, but the biggest incident of violence is when the Basij went in and killed students in Tehran University and busted up dormitories without any provocation. So this is not a case, as Ahmadinejad claimed, of soccer hooligans. Amazing to watch a million demonstrators march silently. This is, I think, one of the strongest examples of nonviolent protest since Gandhi.
Do you think the protests are going to subside, Trudy?
I think one of the most interesting questions is if they go on, if they can maintain this nonviolent protest, I think they will be attacked and possibly they won't be allowed to go on and possibly the opposition leaders will be arrested. But if they manage to come out and can march nonviolently, this will be such a reproach to the regime because if they do what they want to do, they will be attacking absolutely nonviolent demonstrators who are only calling for a fair, just vote.
Let's take a step here into another arena, another area of interest this week, healthcare reform. Moved to center stage, President Obama's hopes for quick action on comprehensive reform ran into the realities of Congress this week as lawmakers searched for the money to pay for the expansion of coverage that Mr. Obama wants. Bill McKenzie, what did you make of the president's jump into the healthcare debate?
Wow, what a week, huh?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I think, you know, he's getting the pushback now. And actually, I think this will probably help Obama some. If you'll notice what the Senate Finance Committee is coming out and taking a couple more weeks to come forward with its own plans because it's concerned about the airtightness, if you will, of the financing part of this. You'll probably see the House move pretty quickly. No surprise there. But I think some of these Senate committees are going to kind of be duking it out and wrestling it out. You see the conservative blue dogs, Democratic members of the House saying, look, you know, we don't want a public plan being the de facto plan. We really only want it to be the one of last resort. I think one of the most interesting things, and I don't think it's gotten a whole lot of press, Bob Dole, Howard Baker, and Tom Daschle came forth with a plan, which I think has some interesting elements. I believe it required people to go out and buy insurance. But what's interesting is it would also move this so-called public plan away from the federal government and have the states kind of run it like they do pools today. Bottom line here is I think people are searching for some sort of compromise on this so-called public plan. And I think this will help Obama because I think we will kind of go through this debate and something will perhaps evolve or we will come with a better financing mechanism than he, Obama, has proposed so far. There are three big elements. There's the delivery of health care, the coverage of people, and the financing of reforms. And I would argue very quickly that the delivery of health care is probably the easiest part. Everybody in both parties pretty much agrees we need to do things like preventive care. The coverage of people gets us in this public plan. It gets us employer mandates. It gets us individual mandates. It gets kind of tricky there. The last part, and this is part where I'm pretty much a radical, is the financing of these reforms. We're looking at least $1 trillion, perhaps $1.6 trillion. Perhaps more. And we need to make sure that this financing scheme is solid. As we've talked about on this program in the past, we are looking at a entitlement deficit of roughly about $54 trillion over the next several decades because the unfunded promises to Medicare and Social Security. And the last thing I'll say is we have a Medicare Hospital Trust Fund that is getting ready to go bankrupt in 8 to 9 years. I don't know how we're going to be able to create a new plan without having it be airtight financed. Mm.
Let's listen for a moment to one senator. Here's Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee. He's talking about this health care reform issue. He said during a Senate hearing that the so-called government option that got so much play this week would drive everyone else from the health care market. Here is his very colorful analogy.
It's like putting an elephant in a room with some mice and saying, all right, fellas, compete. And after a few days, you know what's left. The elephant is all that's left. The mice are crushed, and you have an elephant. That's your only option.
And speaking at a Democratic fundraiser last night in Washington, President Obama fired back at critics of his big health care reform initiative on Capitol Hill.
To those who simply criticize without offering new ideas of their own, I have to ask, what's your answer? What's your answer to all those families who now spend more on health care than on housing or on food?
Jack Beatty, there should be no illusions here. The two parties are far apart on the fundamentals of this reform.
They are far apart. And today, the chairman's mark from the Finance Committee was released, or at least a version of it. And that one seems to be bipartisan, and perhaps to the detriment of the plan. It leaves out the public option. And the hurt of that for the plan as a whole is that it may limit the reach of the plan, that through the public option, self-employed people would be able to get insurance and poorer people could get insurance, but it also limits the cost savings of the plan. It was through the public plan that, after all, that competition was to be offered to the insurance companies, that competition to drive down insurance premiums that are rising at three times the rate of wages. So it's very hard to see how it's a strange situation here where the liberal version, the progressive version, the public plan is actually the one that looks to be more fiscally prudent because of its effect on the overall cost of health care.
Let's listen to White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. He's speaking here to the Democratic Leadership Council in Washington this last week about the administration's plan for health care reform.
To do health care reform, you must change the incentives in the system and the way you control costs. That if you don't do that, and just putting more money into a broken system that has the incentives all upside down, not only with the political system not expand the coverage, you will not get anywhere farther ahead.
Bill McKenzie, how do you see the cost issues playing out here? I mean, $1 trillion or more over 10 years? How should this be paid for?
Well, I think the best idea so far is one McCain had in the election last year, and Obama a couple weeks ago was saying some nice things about it. He's kind of backed off a little bit, and that would be to take the tax break away from the companies get for their health care benefits. Now, nobody at this point is talking about going as far as McCain did and taking away all that tax break and using that for tax credits. What they're talking about is saying, okay, let's get the so-called gold-plated plans, perhaps $13,000 and above, and take away the tax breaks that companies get for that. Estimates show that will raise billions of dollars. I think that's one we really ought to consider. And the reason I like this, that is a tax revenue stream we know is really solid. What Obama's talked about is also taking away, paying less to hospitals who treat a disproportionate share of poor people. And in theory, his Medicare reforms make sense. But here's the problem. In the past, whenever we've changed the way Medicare pays doctors and hospitals come back several years later and say, hey, we're dying. And Congress says, you're right, and we take away whatever changes. And we're going if we go down that road, what worries me is we could have a big hole in this financing scheme 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
Let's get some callers in here who have some thoughts about this issue. William is on the line. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. William, thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I don't know where to start. I'm a guy who voted for Obama, and, obviously he campaigned on the premise that hope and imagining things that were possible was a good thing and that we should be bold in terms of that, kind of hoping for fundamental change. And here, between Baucus and Obama, a single-payer plan is not even on the table.
So you're disappointed by Obama's position so far on this?
Very, very much so. And I think Obama supporters and people who support this plan need to speak up. It may be too late, but it's not too late to talk, because the very guest you've had on your program talk about this as by far the most efficient, effective way to control costs. And it works in so many other countries. And we're not even talking about it. We're not allowed to talk about it. It's not on the table.
Bill McKenzie, go ahead.
Well, I was going to argue. I mean, we're talking about now taking a system perhaps somewhat like Medicare and applying it to people from basically age 25 to 64. And I don't know what our population today is, but it's around 300 million. So there are going to be a big chunk of people in that pool between 25 and 64. And I think we need, while Jack pointed out the fact that premiums are going up, I would just again remind people that if we put this big plan into place and we don't have a way to finance it going forward, we're looking at a humongous debt being put on people in the future, and that future is, you know, going to be coming real soon.
Here's Jack.
I was just going to say, the president has said this is going to be paid for. This is not going to be like the Bush extension of Medicare to prescription drugs, which was charged to posterity. This is going to be paid for one way or another. You know, in my view, the worst campaign promise the president made was when he said repeatedly, nobody with incomes over less than $250,000 is going to pay a dime more in taxes. That promise isn't tenable with the great expansion of public services and government services that he wants to offer. And at some point, reality has to step in. And, you know, the House Ways and Means Committee earlier was talking about perhaps we need to talk about a national value-added tax to support this. That would be an option. Another option would be, as Bill says, the employer, the deduction for employer paid health care. Liquor taxes could go up. There are lots of things, but that promise of the president's, of candidate Obama, no one's going to be paying any it's just not realistic.
Let's go to the phones here before our next break. Trudy, and then I'll let you in here. Jim is on the line from Boston. Go ahead, Jim. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I guess I'm in the rare situation where I agree with a soundbite from John McCain. I really don't want the government to own the insurance itself, but I'm very comfortable with the plan to move forward and have them own the process to get this thing fixed. Without the government involvement, we're never going to get anywhere with all the other supporting things that people are going to want to talk about, like tort reform and all those other things that are really not in the discussion yet, but are certainly going to be a piece of it before it's over.
Absolutely, Jim. Thanks. Trudy Rubin, what about the president's October deadline for getting something to Congress? Realistic, unrealistic? What do you think?
I can't see how it's realistic. I mean, there are so many hot-button issues here, and financing is obviously front and center. At a time when there is still enormously high unemployment for this country, and it's not clear whether that is going to go higher, at a time when many people who do have jobs are being asked to take salary cutbacks, I think even among Democrats, the idea of tax increases on those in the middle income sphere is going to be a very hard sell. And probably it's true that there will have to be tax increases for that segment of society. And so the financing of this is so huge. And as far as the government involvement, what strikes me, it's a big question that I have, if you have partial government employment as a piece of this, then why wouldn't a lot of employers, as some claim, just give up trying to take on the burden of providing health care for their employees and pass it on to the government?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. This week, today, a dead heat election, city council election in Cave Creek, Arizona, was decided by a cut of the cards this week. The King of Hearts beat the Six of Hearts.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Frank, you're up. And the cut of the cards.
Quite a way to win an election there. This week, also more steroid revelations, this time with slugger Sammy Sosa. It's tough to hear his 600th home run the same way again.
Here's the 1-2 pitch. A drive right center field. It is back. It is up. It is 600 for Sosa.
And President Obama, in an interview this week, was bothered by a buzzing fly, an infestation apparently at the White House. Here's the president in action.
Nice.
Now, where were we? That was pretty impressive, wasn't it? I got the sucker.
Nice aim. Joining us this hour is Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. We should talk about the proposals for an historic overhaul of finance rules in this country. On Thursday, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner defended the Obama administration's plans to overhaul the financial sector before the Senate Banking Committee.
We considered a full range of options, and we made the judgment that now was the time to pursue the essential reforms, those that address the core causes of the crisis and those that will help prevent or contain future crises. I want to be clear, our plan does not address and does not seek to address every problem in our financial system. That is not our intent, and we do not propose reforms that, while desirable, would not move us towards achieving those core objectives of creating a more stable system and addressing those vulnerabilities that are critical to our capacity to prevent future crises.
Bill McKenzie, another big government intervention here. How do you see it?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I blame them for some things they're trying. I'm looking at a list here of about 12 to 15 things. I can't begin to explain to them. They remind me kind of a playbook we used to have in junior high where the coach said, you go here, 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 and everybody goes, what, what? You know, you're trying to figure it out. But, you know, they had to try to do something. They're hopefully trying to clarify it when we get these financial documents and we can make sense and know what's going on. Here's the issue, though. This shouldn't be seen just in isolation. I think one of the most interesting things of the week was this Wall Street Journal poll that showed a growing number, and I believe it was a majority of Americans, who were concerned, A, about the deficit and about the growing size of government. And you could make a reasonable case that in terms of autos, in terms of banks, in terms now of financial regulation, and even the stimulus, although I didn't like the way it was spent, we had to do something big, all those things you perhaps can make a rational case for. But we have a growing role for the federal government in our lives, and not to mention what we just finished talking about on health care. And so here are five or six really very big, substantial intrusions of government in our lives, and I think the public is starting to push back some.
Jack Beatty, jump in.
Well, I mean, you could argue that the problems with the finance have been that the government wasn't there, that the government wasn't on the job protecting the interest of the consumer, really, since the Reagan era, and that what we see under Mr. Obama on this front is a correction and a needed one. Now, of course, the other argument is it doesn't go far enough. Yesterday in the New York Times, Jonah Sarah said, this isn't FDR. FDR really reordered the entire system. This stops much short of that, and crucially, it allows institutions to grow to be too big to fail rather than breaking them up, as Paul Volcker and others have suggested they should be broken up. And, of course, the reason it doesn't go that far is that the Democratic Party is supported by Wall Street. That's a terrible admission, I think, for many Democrats to face. But if you look at campaign giving, it is clear that over the last few years, more and more of campaign funds come from Wall Street. So it's very unlikely that this administration or any Democratic or Republican administration would really do something very difficult. Now, moderate and middle ground as this reform may be, there's a substantial chance that it will be put off until 2010, that Congress won't act, and that in the interim, the lobby, the banking lobby, and Senator Durbin has said the banks own the Senate, they will water this down even further. So the future of it is ambiguous, to say the least.
Could I
Trudy,
add
please.
Something? I think that one of the crucial things about this regulatory attempt is that it's dealing with the very element that caused this whole global financial crisis, which is the non-bank banks, as Paul Krugman calls them, the shadow banking system, the shadow bankers who had the possibility to issue all kinds of instruments that even they and their clients didn't understand and were totally unregulated. That is the core of the problem we're facing. So if something wasn't done to regulate them better or regulate them at all, then the whole point of everything that's been done so far, the stimulus and so forth, would seem to be a sham. Whether what Obama does is correct, which is giving the Federal Reserve the power to regulate large financial institutions to take them over if it deems that they're failing, and to compel them to have some capital to back up these kinds of instruments. Whether this is the right approach, I can't say. But I do know that if you don't tackle this particular problem, regulating the shadow banking system, then we haven't made any progress at all.
Listener Sam has a comment on this. Bill McKenzie, and then I'll let you in here. Sam, go ahead. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hello to all the guests. I think the last comment was correct, that he does the banking regulations do take a look at getting the federal agency more involved in it. Unfortunately, there are two aspects to regulation. One is who's doing the regulation and do they have some power? But the other part of it is rules, hard and fast rules, rule of law, not the rule of men. And I think what Obama puts in place is the beginning of an apparatus where agencies can have some power, but the actual rules aren't in place. Rules like the relationship between rating agencies and the instruments that they're rating. He doesn't touch that. That was a huge problem. And I think in the bigger picture as to where Obama stands, I'm really, really worried in terms of a baseball analogy that he's facing three strikes, you're out with the left. I mean, he struck out on Afghanistan and protecting civil rights. I think from the left's point of view, he's kind of striking out on banking regulation. This isn't really strong enough at all to address the core problems. And I fear he's going to strike out on health care reform. And I worry about what that's going to do. I never really did understand his support because he clearly was a centrist. But I think there are a lot of people who are hoping for some real changes. And I worry they're going to be sorely disappointed and alienated from the democratic process.
Sam, thank you. Bill McKenzie, let's hear your thoughts. Do you think the caller is correct, especially on this first point of banking regulations?
I don't think he's a centrist. And if you look what I just talked about, the buildup of the federal government over the last 6 months, even if there are cases to be made for each one, including the financial thing, we have had a very significant buildup of the federal government over the last several months. And in fact, I often think, what does Bill Clinton think about all this? Here's the guy who tried to refashion the party into new Democrats and went with the deficit, went with trade, all these issues. And so here we kind of have more of the traditional Democratic playbook that he's using. I also go back to this poll, which I think is very interesting. And to the caller who may be concerned about the left, I would argue that Obama ought to be more concerned about these numbers that they're seeing here that show more and more people are getting concerned about the size of government and how we pay for it.
That's right. Let me get into more of that because I have it right in front of me here, Bill. The New York Times CBS News poll found a solid majority of Americans believe that President Obama has not developed a strategy for dealing with runaway budget deficits. Another poll, Wall Street Journal, NBC News, found that the president faces challenges on several fronts, including increasing public concern about federal spending and the bailout of the ailing automotive industry. The majority also voiced disapproval of President Obama's determination to close Guantanamo Bay within 1 year. Trudy, what do you hear in those numbers?
You know, Obama faced enormous challenges, as we all know, and he promised to take big steps. And that's why I disagree with the left, because I think the perfect is the enemy of the good. I think he is a centrist, but a center-leftist, and I think that he has done things that he has to do, and he will continue to do so. He has been elected for a 4-year term. Granted, there are midterm elections, but these challenges were so big that he had to take big steps. Regulation, if he didn't, where would we be? Stimulus, had to do it. Health plan, that was the core of his election platform. So, of course, the numbers are going to go down because these are really big issues. But where was the public when the Republicans were running up the deficit? I mean, some things you have to do, and I think that's the approach he's going to take, and he'll be judged on the effectiveness.
Jack,
it has to go the way he promised.
Jack Beatty, jump in. What do you think about these numbers?
Well, I think the public anxiety about the deficit is to a certain extent misplaced. We are in the most serious recession since the Great Depression. And with all that means for the increase in government spending for welfare expenditures, unemployment, the drop in tax receipts and the like, that's what a recession means. It means the deficits go up. And Obama came in with a huge structural deficit, according to David Leonhardt of the New York Times. Obama's plans, the things he's proposed, would account for roughly about 6 to 10% of the deficit. The bulk of it is the recession on the one hand and the Bush tax cuts on the other. And my view is that he's got to deal, first of all, with the recession. We've got to get the economy going again, get economic activity going again. And he's got to really think about those Bush tax cuts that as unaffordable if he wants to go along with his own 10% of, that program of government expansion. I mean, the public, you know, it's good to worry about the deficit in good times, but in times like now, we need to run a deficit in order to stimulate the economy, and the public doesn't seem to get that at this moment.
Former President George W. Bush actually made reference to President Obama this week. He appeared in Pennsylvania, and he talked about many things, but he said he hopes his successor's plans to close Guantanamo Bay, the detention facility at Gitmo, will not compromise domestic security. Bill McKenzie, what do you make of his appearance? What do you make of him breaking his silence? I mean, what do you make of his comments?
Well, he also said in there that he was not going to criticize Obama, and he had made that very clear when he left the White House, and so far he has not. I mean, think what he's not taking the Dick Cheney line on this by any stretch of the imagination. You know, he's at an event in Pennsylvania. He makes his comments, but he is not throwing trash at Obama. So I think there's a big difference. I think this also reveals some of the split there was within the Bush White House between some of the Cheney forces and some of the Bush forces.
Trudy Rubin, I'd like to get you back in here because on another matter, you traveled to Afghanistan and Pakistan last month, and I'm curious what your reactions were in that region, specifically those two places.
Well, in Pakistan, I think one of the most incredible stories is the turnaround of the government and the army and the opposition, political opposition, on fighting the Taliban, on the Taliban internally as Pakistan's enemy, not just America's, which has the public in Pakistan and the press have taken the position for a long time that this was America's war. And because the Taliban overreached, the public became angry. The army has been sent in. The critical element, however, is whether what they clear can be held and whether it can be rebuilt. There is a terrible refugee problem in Pakistan. About 3 million people have fled out of the areas where the army is fighting. They are fodder for Taliban recruitment. Angela Jolie yesterday and her husband pledged $1 million to the UN's Campaign for Refugee Relief. What's needed is $500 million just for humanitarian aid. The U.S. has given a large chunk of that. The world is not contributing. But then comes the rebuilding. Who's going to do it? Is the Pakistan government capable of it? Can we do more? And I think this is going to be the critical question as to whether Pakistan, a country with nuclear weapons, which still has an internal big Islamist threat and has al-Qaeda up in its tribal lands in the northwest, whether it can be stabilized and one can prevent a country that does have terrorists and nuclear weapons from the two coming together. As far as Afghanistan, you know, I was there when the buildup was starting. You see a country where the population does not want the Taliban, is wary of the Americans, and the question is whether we can help them stabilize the country and then leave. I think there's a possibility. There's a good team in place, U.S. But again, can it be held and built? And there's a real problem there with U.S. aid agencies, with international aid agencies. So we'll see this summer.
Let's get back and finish this hour with some numbers from the U.S. Jobless claims fall for the first time in 21 weeks. Total number of people on unemployment insurance has dropped for the first time since January. First-time claims for benefits rose slightly. But overall, it's an indication that layoffs may be easing. That drop also breaks a string of 21 consecutive increases. The last of 19 of them were at record highs. So some bright signs on the horizon, Bill McKenzie, for the economy?
That's good. And I think this kind of, you know, circles back to what Jack was talking about a second ago. I would agree with Jack that in the short term, we need to worry less about the deficits. And if these numbers indicate perhaps the economy is going to be turning around, maybe we'll be having a different conversation in a year from now or 18 months from now. Hopefully we will. We all want that. Nevertheless, I still think that the long-term effect of what we're looking at in terms of the debt will make this current economic crisis look like an afternoon at the beach because the numbers are so big.
20 seconds left. Jack Beatty, I'll give you the final word.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, we have to do something about the level of expenditure in our government. Obama wants the government expenditure to be about a little less than it was under Bill Clinton, but to be doing much more. I don't see how you can do that. You know, already the United States gets 45% of our revenue from the highest income earners. They're tapped out. And the rest of us, I think, are going to have to pay for the services that we need from the government. Mm.
Well, a big news week and a great discussion today. Thanks to all my guests. Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you so much, Trudy.
No, you're welcome.
Bill McKenzie with the Dallas Morning News. Many thanks to you, Bill. Thanks.
Thank you all. Great fun.
And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.